Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Peter Frank. Peter Frank is a lawyer and has been an activist lawyer for many years. He's one of the founders of the National Lawyers Guild Center on Democratic Communications and is also a staff member on that center. So I think to put it in context, Peter, we'll start out talking about what is the National Lawyers Guild Center on Democratic Communications. So, because you have such a wide breadth of work that you've been doing even now as we speak.
Well, Sue, thanks for having me. Let's start with what is the National Lawyers Guild. The National Lawyers Guild is an association of lawyers, legal workers, and law students that was formed by radical New Deal lawyers and legal workers back in the 1930s, in the Roosevelt era. And all these years, it sees itself as the legal arm of the movement or movements in the United States for social change, for a more just society. We work in a whole lot of different areas, prisoner rights, criminal law, lots of things. Our Center for Democratic Institutions is the organization that is committed to working for the democratization of the media and to give legal representation and support to people seeking to democratize the media.
Well, if people have been listening to my show, they've heard me talk about how undemocratic and how centralized and corporate and controlled the media is many, many times, and practically every show I do, I come back to that subject and the importance of the media. So I just want to say that again in case people wonder why does the media need to be democratized? And maybe you'd like to say a little bit more about what that means and how you got involved.
Well, I first became active in what we used to call, maybe still do, the New Left, the activism of the late 50s, early 1960s here in the Bay Area. And very early I saw that we would put on a demonstration or a rally and have lots of people, be very successful, and read about it the next day in the newspaper, and you wonder what state the reporter had been in, let alone what rally he or she had been in. And we soon learned that if you allow the media to distort your message, you can't accomplish anything in terms of the movement for social justice. And more broadly, if you allow the media to screw up kids' heads with sexist and violent cartoons on Saturday morning, messed up values, distorted information about what goes on in the rest of the world outside the United States, you can't hope to have a successful movement for a just society when people's culture and values are screwed up from an early age and when their information is filtered. So that it's a necessary element of having a moving towards a democratic society to have a democratic media system.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you use the word allow. Allow the media as if we have some control over it.
Well, there's their media and there's our media.
Which is what you're hearing. Whatever you're listening to this program on now is probably not, I could pretty much guarantee, it's not the corporate-owned media.
Oh, you mean this is not the Fox Network?
I doubt it.
You know, there's two threads, there has been for quite a while, in the movement or movements to do something about the media situation. There have been for many years attempts to reform the mainstream media. There's what used to be called the Fairness Doctrine, which was a rule by the Federal Communications Commission that basically said that you had to give both sides of important issues. That went out the window during the Reagan era. attempts to make the big corporate media behave more democratically have not generally been very successful. It really existed on the margins. The other part of it is to have our own media, which I think is what's really important. As you know, I was involved heavily in Pacifica Radio, Pacifica Foundation, the five oldest, largest listener-sponsored radio stations in this country. I was involved with it back in the 70s and 80s particularly. Pacifica is now going through a huge struggle to maintain its original commitment. It's being pulled off in a totally different direction. Another movement that's been very important is what we call the movement for micro radio, or what the Federal Communications Commission calls LPFM or low power FM. These are small community-based non-commercial stations under 100 watts of power with a range of 5 to 15 miles transmitter, usually, which can be put on the air for $1,000, $2,000, which the government banned for 25 years. And there was a major movement of civil disobedience, really, starting about 12 years ago, people defying that ban, saying it's a free speech right to go on the air, speak to the community when nothing else is serving the community. My organization, the Center for Democratic Communications, has been very much involved in the legal defense of people doing that. And we had some initial success in court, which helped this movement grow. So at its peak, about 3 or 4 years ago, there were about 1,000 unlicensed stations. The government would say illegal, but we consider the rules unlawful, so we say unlicensed, on the air, which forced the Federal Communications Commission, the agency which regulates broadcasting in this country, to take another look at its ban, and they legalized it just about a year ago. Then there's been a big battle in Congress with the broadcasting industry and the establishment part of the public radio industry, national public radio, trying to push a bill through Congress to illegalize, in other words, to overturn the FCC and keep these low-power, cheap community stations from being on the air. A law did pass a few weeks ago that does that to some degree, but there's still room for a fair amount of these stations, and we're also seriously looking at constitutional challenge to the ban on low-power, cheap community radio.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to kind of repeat what you just said a little bit, because I'm involved in the micro-radio movement, and my listeners may or may not know that. But I talk about this subject a lot, and I find people very surprised that National Public Radio, and they confuse National Public Radio with Pacifica, with micro radio, with community radio, and when I say they led the fight, or are leading the fight to ban the small unlicensed so far stations, it's very hard to get that. To understand that that's what's happening, and they sort of, so that's why I'm repeating it, because I want people to understand that we are talking about something different, and we are talking about the issue of democratization of media really is about free speech.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard to get it to know why National Public Radio, which is really in the United States the government-funded radio system, is opposing it until you really take a look at it. One person who was inside, who you know, Sue, who was inside some of the meetings at National Public Radio early on, told me that National Public Radio was scared of losing audience to these small stations because they have pushed their so-called non-commercial stations to do mostly national programming. The NPR and National Public Radio stations do very little local originated programming, and the micro radio stations, by definition, being small and local, and by rules that we suggested to the FCC in which they adopted in terms of keeping the programming local, will serve their local programs, local communities. And they're going to fill a niche that NPR has abandoned, and it should be filled. But NPR is very much concerned about loss of audience. That's, I would say, 50% of the reason that NPR has been so strongly opposed to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, I don't know the age of the listeners or where you are, but there used to be a lot more just community. I mean, in small towns would have their own stations. There was much more diversity of stations, and probably a lot of times people don't. I mean, and there is this thing about all these, there are these cable channels, there's all these on the TV, and the radio is, a dial is getting larger, and the spectrum is getting bigger. I guess maybe that's not true. You can talk about that, Peter Frank, but it looks like there's a lot of diversity and a lot of choice. But in fact, most of those are owned by the same companies, which are mostly exist to make money.
That's right. On the radio band itself, the band itself is not expanding. There's limited space, and it's not changing because the receivers are not changing. The Congress passed...
What's the big deal about digital? Some people sound like it's a very big deal and it's going to create more space. But if I just got that wrong, but probably if I do, maybe some other people do too.
Digital radio, as people probably know, normal or old-fashioned radio, normal radio, what we're listening to is what's called analog. It's been around for a long time. It's like a phonograph record was analog and a CD is digital. So digital technology allows a lot more information to be passed in the same basic space. You can put much more information on a digital CD than on a phonograph record of the same physical size. Radio is going to go digital on the same frequencies as the current stations are. So we have the ABC affiliate here, KGO, is on 90.950 or something. When it becomes a digital transmitter, it'll be on the same frequency, and it'll be owned by the same company. In the case of ABC, the Disney Company, Walt Disney Company. A digital station can carry more information. Digital receivers will have a little LCD thing on it, so you'll be able to look and see what song you're listening to. And there could be a greater diversity of information. But so long as the ownership of the stations is the same, it's not going to change. The Congress, as I said before, passed a very big revision of the Communications Act in 1996, and it wiped out almost all of the restrictions on one corporation having lots of radio stations, for instance, in the same general area. I think there's in the San Francisco Bay Area, this number is rough. There's about six major corporations that own 35 or 40 of the channels. Since the Telecommunications Act revision, almost half of the 11,000 FM stations, radio stations in the United States, have changed hands, and they've almost all gone from small groups or independent ownership to being owned by huge multinationals. So you can travel up and down the dial, and you get lots of stations and lots of call signs, but the music's the same, the news is the same, the information is the same. There's no true diversity. And speaking of diversity, minority ownership of broadcast outlets has gone down from a pitiful about 2.4% before this revision of the law to about 1.3% now, even though the law was touted as creating more diversity. Mm-hmm. So we have a consolidation of the media and much less information available, and 90% of it generated by corporate outlets owned by Fox and Disney and so on. And then you have another major player, National Public Radio, headed by a man whose whole career was in Voice of America, Radio Marti. His career was close, his name. His career was in making the propaganda of the United States government to the people of the world overseas. Now he comes and runs National Public Radio, where his job is really making the propaganda of the U.S. government to the people of the United States. That's what's really going on. So that's not an independent outlet. And then you have the Pacifica radio stations, the five listener-sponsored stations that were formed in the wake of the Cold War, beginning of the Cold War in the late 40s, being pressured mightily also by the same public broadcasting establishment to change their whole style and be no more radical than the public broadcasting, National Public Radio. So we're in danger of losing these outlets, and we really need to fight to create more independent ones.
Mm-hmm. So it's squashing any opposition to the government, basically,
yes.
To government policy.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's what it's really about. The micro radio stations or the Pacifica radio stations, listener-sponsored stations, the way I think about it, they're the little boy who, or maybe a little girl, who says the emperor has no clothes. When the United States bombs Yugoslavia, all the media, and boy, National Public Radio was leading the charge of saying, oh yeah, we got to bomb Milosevic, is as bad as Hitler, we got to bomb, therefore we have to bomb the people of Yugoslavia. You get a national consensus on this. When small independent stations, listener-sponsored stations of the new micro-radio stations say, hey, wait a minute, maybe that's not right, you break the consensus, and that's really profoundly subversive, and that's why there's a lot of government energy going into squelching this movement, because It's like the little boy says, the emperor has no clothes. One little voice says it, and people start to think. Nobody says it, and people think, well, that's the universe. Mm-hmm.
Well, Peter Frank, you also mentioned before we came on to the recording here, the interview, that you were involved in a case that was fighting some challenging some basic communications regulations in the United States. Would you speak about that?
Yes, this is something called the Democratic Media Legal Project. And we're now in, we have a grant, and we're now in the research and planning phase. The basis of the First Amendment, classically put forward by Alexander Micklejohn, says that the reason for the First Amendment, freedom of speech, is so that the citizens can have a broad array of information and ideas to select from when they're voting. And we learned a few months ago that the voting may not count much, but let's put that aside for a moment. What we find after 65 years of a media system based on commercial sponsorship is that the range of views is extremely narrow, not very broad, and lots of relevant and important points of view are excluded by a present media system. That violates the purpose and the principles of the First Amendment. Therefore, in our view, it's unconstitutional to have a media system based on private profit, and so we're challenging the 1934 Telecommunications Act.
Mm-hmm. So is your vision to see only not-for-profit media?
The remedy we're probably going to propose, broadcast licenses in this country are good for a period of 5 or 7 years and have to be renewed. Renewal used to mean something. Now they just send in a postcard. But the remedy we're going to ask the court for is that the first 50% of commercial broadcast licenses which come up for renewal don't get renewed. So we recover that half of the radio and television spectrum space for non-commercial media. And our notion is that you'd have many different types. You'd have more microstations, more community radio stations like Pacifica and other smaller community stations. You might have one national channel like Ralph Nader has been advocating for years. You could have a multifaceted media system, none of it controlled by the imperatives of advertising, some of it big and sort of nationally run, some of it very small, some of it in between. So you get a whole lot of different voices, a whole lot of different communities represented, a whole lot of patterns of decision-making, and you get a much more diverse media system so that the full range of views that the informed citizenry needs are really out there. And so you at least balance the terrible culture that comes from the Saturday morning TV. I mean, Pacifica Radio, when it started in the 40s and early 50s, had wonderful children's programming. And everybody knows, but nobody does much about it, that there's a huge need for good, wholesome programming for children on radio and television. And commercial Saturday morning TV for children is just a marketing device. It's cartoons designed to have stick figures that the kids will make the parents go out and buy them. And that's got to really change.
Yeah. Well, and of course, they're being very successful, to say the least. One of the reasons that I spoke earlier about people's age and what they remember is that this, what looks to me like loss of free speech and loss of our rights, it kind of sneaks up. It's like this warm water thing, and I noticed that a lot of young people, even activists, I mean, they have no reason to really understand how it was before they were even born. And but it was different. I mean, far from perfect, but really different. So do you find that? Would you comment on general rights of free speech since you're an attorney concerned with these things, Peter Frank?
Well, I don't know if I can add much. The right of free speech is absolutely central to the notion of democratic self-government. If you don't have free speech, you don't have democratic self-government. And even though the term we tend to use is freedom of speech, that's the term that comes out of the Constitution, freedom of the press, the more modern term really comes out of the United Nations system. The Universal Declaration for Human Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Social Rights, talks about a right to communicate. And the right to people to get all points of view and all kinds of culture. And I think the important right is a positive right of the hearers to hear a broad variety of ideas, culture, and information. And without that, you don't have an open society controlled from the bottom up. You just have a society that's being manipulated from the top down.
A lot of people also in this country, in the United States, think because that's what we learn in school when I was a child, and still I think it's what people learn in school and from the media, that this is the most democratic, free country in the world. Do you think that's true, or is there more freedom of the press and freedom of speech in any other places? Or anything you'd like to say about that?
Well, it must be true because the media tells us it's true every day. if you go to Europe and even look at the European editions of Newsweek or the Herald Tribune, the American press, that are published for people from the United States traveling overseas, there's a lot more information in the news than the same publications here, because they know that they can't get away with all the filtering and censorship when people have got access to Le Monde and the Guardian in England and those kind of papers. So I don't think it's the most democratic. If democracy is just an exercise in ratification based on no real information, then it's not democratic. And some of the European countries, I think, are more democratic. Certainly some smaller and simpler societies are more democratic.
Well, the next question, what do you think about this recent elections, and what do you foresee for the future here with the subjects that we're talking about democracy, free speech, media, rights, basically? Mm-hmm. Peter Frank is my guest, who is with the National Lawyers Guild Center on Democratic Communications.
Well, Bush didn't win the election. Gore lost it. Both by just not being a very good candidate and by allowing the Republicans to be way over aggressive in the end game that took place after the election. It was really stolen, which is a bad sign. I mean, it was really a silent coup, and that's not good for the future. In terms of the issues we're concerned about, it means we're going to have a much more conservative Federal Communications Commission, and we're worried about what they're going to do about the new procedures for micro radio, small radio stations. It means that while there was some antitrust pressure against the huge monopoly media from the government, that's going to go away. The new chair of the Federal Communications Commission is going to be almost certainly going to be Michael Powell, whose daddy is Colin Powell, our new Secretary of State, who's a Michael is actually more conservative than his father, and thinks that the FCC should get out of the way of business doing all the media stuff. So,
has he been working in media?
He's been a member of the Federal Communications Commission for the last about 5 years. I don't think he's worked in media before that, but he's been on the commission. The commission is supposed to have 2 members from the party out of power and 3 members from the party in power. So there are 2 Republicans, and Powell was one of the 2 Republicans. It's been on for quite some time.
So it's definitely a political office.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. So do-it-yourself media is really where it's at. The micro-radio movement started with people going on the air without a buyer leaf from the government. The pioneer was a blind, unemployed black man by the name of Ibana Kantako from Springfield, Illinois, which is southern Illinois, which is an extremely conservative, racist area. Mabana got from some catalog a couple of little black boxes, strung them together with 1 watt of power, and he lived in a housing project, which was where almost the entire black community lived. So with 1 watt of power, he had about 1.5 miles radius, 3 mile diameter. He was talking to the whole black community, a very small station. And what's interesting about this and his story, and sort of typical, is that even though he didn't have a license, and you're supposed to have a license if you broadcast, nobody bothered him. Until the housing authority police beat up some kids in the projects, and Mabana put the kids on the air to tell their story, and 2 days later, the Federal Communications Commission, accompanied by the housing authority police, was knocking on the door saying, "You can't go on the radio. You can't go on the air without a license." A friend of his, a professor at a nearby college, contacted us and said, "Could we help him?" And that's how my organization got involved in researching the question of, was this ban on low-power radio constitutional? We came to the conclusion it was not constitutional. And following his example, and then a little bit later, Stephen Dunifer, a activist in the San Francisco Bay Area, who saw that there was a total blackout. He's an engineer, and he was on the Internet before most of us were. And he saw that during the Gulf War, 200,000 people marched in Berlin against the U.S. policy, and not a word of it in the press here. So he started with just a few watts Free Radio Berkeley, and the government tried to shut him down, and we used the legal work theories that we developed from Urbana and convinced the court that there were some real serious free speech issues. in that case. And that gave encouragement to this movement of civil disobedience to really grow, so there's a whole lot of stations. And we've told the broadcast industry that if they try to shut it down, instead of having regulated small stations with frequencies where everybody knows and, you know, orderly system, that they're going to pop up, there's going to be more civil disobedience to pop up all over the place, because the technology is cheap and simple, and there's an overwhelming need to have independent alternative information.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always hope with these programs that we do about this matter that people at least get more critical about the media, the system, and spread the word to their friends, because the whole deal is if you don't know, you don't know. Usually, right. And if you, and since the media, as you say, is so incredibly important in shaping just about the way we think,
yeah.
And what we know, it's really important that we use the media. I agree, which is mm-hmm. what we're doing right now. So, Peter, our time is about up, and maybe you'd like to give some contacts for the National Lawyers Guild Center on Democratic Communications. And anything else you want to say in a minute.
Okay. Well, let's be modern. I'll give the web page address first. It's www.nlgcdc.org. It stands for National Lawyers Guild Center on Democratic Communications.org. So nlgcdc.org is our web page. People can contact us at our phone number here in the San Francisco Bay Area at 415-522-9914. 415-522-9914, or write to us at 3450 Geary Boulevard, Suite 208, San Francisco, 94118. We'd very much like to hear from anybody who has thoughts, concerns, and ideas about this. Our webpage is the best place to get updates on what's happening with the micro-radio movement and legal situation, because it's a fast-changing situation legally, and we post updates right away.
Well, we do have a few more seconds left, and then maybe if you could say real quickly kind of where things are at right now. Are there going to be licensing small stations or not? Is it totally dead? Or
the FCC is taking license applications for these small stations in five groups, divided up the country in five different groups. They already have the applications in for the first two of the five. They had about 1,200 applications. They've announced that there'll be about 400 stations they can license. That's less than half what there would have been, but that's been restricted by this new bill in Congress. So they will be licensing them. The law that just went through makes the situation more complicated, and anybody who's already applied should look at our webpage, talk to an advisor, a lawyer, or somebody else to see whether they have to make some modifications. And this is going to go on, and there's people in Colorado and other parts of the middle of the country have about two more weeks to apply. And then there'll be some more opportunities later on. Again, check our webpage for the exact times. So they will be. We're probably going to challenge the ban on the more powerful stations. So there's a lot of opportunity. It's a fight that's gotten a little tougher, but that's what makes us strong.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Peter Frank of the National Lawyers Guild Center on Democratic Communications. And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.